car carefully so it wouldn't run over anybody if it started. The boy let off the brake and put it in high, and when they were ready he sat in the seat so full of hope and fear that his whole body was one tight concentration. His father stooped, his cheek pressed against the radiator as a milker's cheek touches the flank of a cow. His shoulder dropped, jerked up. Nothing. Another jerk. Nothing. Then he was rolling in a furious spasm of energy, the wet, dark back of his shirt rising and falling. Inside the motor, there was only the futile swish of the choke and the half-sound, half-feel of cavernous motion as the crankshaft turned over. The Ford bounced on its spring as if its front wheels were coming off the ground on every upstroke. Then it stopped, and the father was hanging on the radiator, breathless, dripping wet, swearing, "Son of a dirty, lousy, stinking, corrupted!" The boy stared from his father's angry, wet face to his mother's, pinched with worry. The pup lay down in the shade and put its head on its paws.
"Gee whiz," the boy said. "Gee whiz."
He looked at the sun, and the morning was half gone. Jerking with anger, his father threw the crank halfway across the yard and took a step or two toward the house.
"The hell with the damn thing," he said.
"Bo, you can't."
He stopped, glared at her, took an oblique look at Bruce, bared his teeth in an irresolute, silent swear word.
"But God, if it won't go!"
"Maybe if you hitch the horses to it," she said.
His laugh was short and choppy.
"That'd be fine," he said. "Why don't we just hitch the team to this damned old boat and pull it into Chinook?"
"But we've got to get it started. Why wouldn't it be all right to let the team pull it around? You push it on a hill sometimes and it starts."
He looked at the boy again, jerked his eyes away exasperatedly as though he held his son somehow accountable. The boy stared, mournful, defeated, ready to cry, and his father's head swung back unwillingly. Then abruptly he winked, mopped his head and neck, and grinned.
"Think you want to go, huh?"
The boy nodded.
"All right," his father said crisply. "Fly up in the pasture and get the team. Hustle!"
On the high lope, the boy was off up the coulee bank. Under the lip of the swale, a quarter of a mile west, the bay backs of the horses and the black dot of the cold showed. Usually he ran circumspectly across that pasture because of the cactus, but now he flew. With shoes it was all right, and even without shoes he would have run. Across burnouts, over stretches so undermined with gopher holes that sometimes he broke through to the ankle, skimming over patches of cactus, soaring over a badger hole, plunging into the coulee and up the other side, he ran as if bears were after him. The black colt, spotting him, lifted his tail and took off in a spectacular stiff-legged sprint, but the bays merely lifted their heads and watched. He slowed, came up walking, laid a hand on the mare's neck and untied the looped halter rope. She stood for him while he scrambled and kicked himself up, and then they were off, the mare in an easy lope, the gelding trotting after, the colt stopping his wild show-off career and wobbling hastily and ignominiously after his departing mother. They pulled up before the Ford, and the boy slid off to throw the halter rope to his father.
"Shall I get the harness?" he said.
And before anyone could answer, he was off running to come back, dragging one heavy harness with the tugs trailing. He dropped it, turned to run again, his breath laboring in his lungs.
"I'll get the other'n," he said.
With a short, almost incredulous laugh, Bo looked once at Elsa and threw the harness over the mare. When the second one came, he laid it on the gelding, pushed against the heavy shoulder to get the horse into place. The gelding resisted, pranced a little, got a curse and a crack across the nose, jerked back and trembled and lifted his feet nervously, and set one shod hoof on his owner's instep. Bo, unstrung by the heat and the hurry and the labor and the exasperation of a morning when nothing went right, kicked the gelding in the belly.
"Get in there, you damn big blundering ox! Back up, back up! Ho now, ho!"
With a heavy rope for a tow line and the disengaged trees of the wagon for a rig, he He hitched the now skittish team to the car. Without a word, he stooped and lifted the boy to the mare's back. "All right," he said, and his face relaxed in a quick grin. "This is where we start her. Ride them around in a circle, not too fast." Then he climbed into the Ford, turned the switch to magneto, fussed with the levers. "Let her go," he said. The boy kicked the mare ahead, twisting as he rode to watch the Ford heave forward off the jack as a tired, heavy man heaves to his feet and begin rolling after him over the uneven ground, jerking and kicking and growling when his father put it in gear. The horses settled as the added weight came on the line, flattened into their collars, swung in a circle, bumped each other, skittered. The mare reared, and the boy shut his eyes and clung. When he came down, her leg was entangled in the tug, and his father was climbing, cursing, out of the car to straighten her out. His father was mad again and yelled at him, "Keep him apart! There isn't any tongue. You gotta keep Dick over on his own side." Now again, the start. The flattening into the collars, the snapping tight of the tugs. This time it went smoothly. The Ford galloped after the team in lumbering, plunging jerks. The mare's eyes rolled white, and she broke into a trot, pulling the gelding after her. Desperately the boy clung to the knotted and shortened reins, his ears alert for the grumble of the Ford starting behind him. The pup ran beside the team, yapping, crazy with excitement. They made three complete circles of the back yard between house and chicken coop before the boy looked back again. "Won't she start?" he yelled. He saw his father rigid behind the wheel, heard his ripping burst of swear words, saw him bend and glare down into the mysterious inwards of the engine through the pulled-up floorboards. Guiding the car with one hand, he fumbled down below, one glaring eye just visible over the cowl. "Shall I stop?" the boy shouted. Excitement and near despair made his voice a tearful scream. But his father's wild arm waved him on. "Go on, go on! Gallop him! Pull the guts out of this thing!" And the galloping, the furious, mud-flinging, rolling-eyed galloping around the circle already rutted like a road, the Ford now in savagely held low, growling and surging and plowing behind, the mad yapping of the dog, the erratic, scared bursts of runaway from the colt, the boy's mother in sight briefly for a quarter of each circle, her hands to her mouth and her eyes sick, and behind him in the Ford his father in a strangling rage, yelling him on, his lips back over his teeth and his face purple. Until finally they stopped, the horses blowing, the boy white and tearful and still, the father dangerous with unexpended wrath. The boy slipped off, his lip bitten between his teeth, not crying now, but ready to at any moment, the corners of his eyes prickling with it, and his teeth locked on his misery. His father climbed over the side of the Ford and stood looking as if he wanted to tear it apart with his bare hands, shoulders sagging, tears trembling to fall, jaw aching with the need to cry. The boy started toward his mother. As he came near his father, he looked up, their eyes met, and he saw his father's blank with impotent rage. Dull hopelessness swallowed him. Not any of it, his mind said, not even any of it. No parade, no ball game, no band, no fireworks. No lemonade or ice cream or paper horns or firecrackers, no close sight of the mountains that throughout four summers had called like a legend from his horizons, no trip, no adventure, none of it, nothing. Everything he felt was in that one still look. In spite of him, his lip trembled, and he choked on a sob, his eyes on his father's face, on the brows pulling down and the eyes narrowing. "Well, don't blubber," his father shouted at him. "Don't stand there looking at me as if I was to blame for your missed picnic."
"I can't help it,"
the boy said, and with terror he felt the grief swelling up, overwhelming him, driving his voice out of him in a wail. Through the blur of his crying he saw the convulsive tightening of his father's face, and then all the fury of a maddening morning concentrated itself in a swift backhand blow that knocked the boy staggering. He bawled aloud from pain, from surprise, from outrage, from pure desolation, and ran to bury his face in his mother's lap. From that muffled sanctuary he heard her angry voice. "No," she said. "Go on away somewhere till he gets over it." She rocked him against her, but the voice she had for his father was bitter. "As if he wasn't hurt enough already," she said. He heard the heavy, quick footsteps going away, and for a long time he lay crying into the voyle flowers. When he had cried himself out, and had listened apathetically to his mother's soothing promises that they would go in the first chance they got, go to the mountains, have a picnic under some waterfall, maybe be able to find a ball game going on in town some Saturday, when he had listened and become quiet, wanting to believe it but not believing it at all, he went inside to take his good clothes and his shoes off and put on his old overalls again. It was almost noon when he came out to stand in the front yard looking southward toward the impossible land where the mountains of the moon lifted above the plains, and where in the town below the peaks crowds would now be eating picnic lunches, drinking pop, getting ready to go out to the ball ground and watch heroes in real uniforms play ball. The band would be braying now from a bunting-wrapped stand. Kids would be playing in a cool grove, tossing firecrackers. In the still heat, his eyes searched the horizon for the telltale watermark. There was nothing but waves of heat, crawling and lifting like invisible flames. The horizon was a blurred and writhing flatness where earth and sky met in an indistinct band of haze. This morning a stride would have taken him there. Now it was gone. Looking down, he saw at his feet the clean footprint he had made in the early morning. Aimlessly he put his right foot down and pressed. The mud was drying, but in a low place he found a spot that would still take an imprint. Very carefully, as if he performed some ritual for his life, he went around stepping and leaning, until he had a circle 6 feet in diameter of delicately exact footprints, straight edge and curving instep, and the 5 round dots of toes. Chapter 3. His father's voice awakened him next morning. Stretching his back, arching against the mattress, he looked over at his parents' end of the porch. His mother was up too, though he could tell from the flatness of the light outside that it was still early. He lay on his back, letting complete wakefulness come on, watching a spider that dangled on a golden shining thread from the rolled canvas of the blinds. The spider came down in tiny jerks, his legs wriggling, and then went up again in the beam of sun. From the other room his father's voice rose loud and cheerful. "Oh, I'd give every man in the army a quarter if they'd all take a shot at my mother-in-law." The boy slid his legs out of bed and yanked the nightshirt over his ears. He didn't want his father's face poking around the door saying, "I plow deep while sluggards sleep." He didn't want to be joked with. Yesterday was too sore a spot in his mind. He had been avoiding his father ever since the morning before, and he was not yet ready to accept any joking or attempts to make up. Nobody had a right hitting a person for nothing, and you bet they weren't going to be friends. Let him whistle and sing out there, pretending that nothing was the matter. The whole awful morning yesterday was the matter. The missed 4th of July was the matter. That crack on the ear was the matter. In the other room, as he pulled on his overalls, the bacon was snapping in the pan, and he smelled its good morning smell. His father whistled, sang, "In the town of O'Geary lived Paddy O'Flanagan, battered away till he hadn't a pound. His father, he died, and he made him a man again, left him a farm of 10 acres of ground." Bruce pulled the overall straps up and went into the main room. His father stopped singing and looked at him. "Hello, cheerful," he said. "You look like you bit into a wormy apple." The boy mumbled something and went out to wash at the bench. It wasn't any fun waking up today. You kept thinking about yesterday and how much fun it had been waking up then, when you were going to do something special and fancy. Now there wasn't anything to do except the same old things. Run the traps, put out some poison, read the Sears Roebuck catalog. At breakfast he was glum, and his father joked him. Even his mother smiled, as if she had forgotten already how much wrong had been done the day before. "You look as if you had been sent for and couldn't come," she said. "Cheer up."
"I don't want to cheer up."
They just smiled at each other, and he hated them both. After breakfast, his father said, "You help your ma with the dishes now. See how useful you can make yourself around here." Unwillingly, wanting to get out of the house and away from them, he got the towel and swabbed away. He was rubbing a glass when he heard the Ford sputter and race and roar, and then calm down into a steady mutter. His mouth opened, and he looked up at his mother. Her eyes were crinkled up with smiling.
"It goes," he said.
"Sure it goes."
She pulled both his ears, rocking his head.
"Know what we're going to do?"
"What?"
"We're going to the mountains. Not to Chinook, there wouldn't be anything doing there today, but to the mountains for a picnic. Pa got the car going yesterday afternoon when you were down in the field, so we decided then. If you want to, of course."
"Yay!"
he said. "Shall I dress up?"
"Put on your shoes, you'd better. We might climb a mountain."
The boy was out into the porch in three steps. With one shoe on and the other in his hand, he hopped to the door.
"When?"
he said. "Soon as you can get ready." He was trying to run and tie his shoelaces at the same time as he went out of the house. There in the Ford, smoking his pipe with one leg over the door and his weight on the back of his neck, his father sat.
"What detained you?" he said. "I've been waiting a half hour. You must not want to go very bad."
"Ah," the boy said. He looked inside the car. There was the lunch all packed, the fat, wet canvas water bag, even Spot with his tongue out and his ears up. Looking at his father, all his sullenness gone now, the boy said,
"When did you get all this ready?"
His father grinned.
"Why, you slept like a sluggard. We worked like a buggard," he said.
Then Bruce knew that everything was perfect. Nothing could go wrong. When his father started rhyming things, he was in his very best mood, and not even flat tires and breakdowns could make him do more than puff and play act. He clambered into the front seat and felt the motor shaking under the floorboards.
"Hey, Ma!" he yelled. "Hurry up! We're all ready to go!"
Their own road was a barely marked trail that wiggled out across the burnouts along the east side of the wheat field. At the line it ran into another, coming down from the homesteads to the east. And at Cree, a mile inside the Montana boundary, they hit the straight section line road to Chinook. On that road they passed a trotting team pulling an empty wagon, and the boy waved and yelled, feeling superior, feeling as if he were charioted upon pure speed and all the rest of the world were earth-footed.
"Let's see how fast this old boat will go," his father said.
He nursed it down through a coulee and onto the flat. His finger pulled the gas lever down and the motor roared. Looking back with the wind-stung tears in his eyes, the boy saw his mother hanging to her hat and the artificial grapes bouncing. The Ford leaped and bucked. The picnic box tipped over. The dog leaned out and the wind blew his eyes shut and his ears straight back. Turning around, the boy saw the blue sparks jumping from the magneto box and heard his father's wahoo. He hung on to the side and leaned out to let the wind tear at him. Tried to count the fence posts going by, but they were ahead of him before he got to 10. The road roughened, and they slowed down.
"Good land," his mother said from the back seat. "We want to get to Bear Paws, not wind up in a ditch. How fast were we going, Pa?"
40 or so. If we'd been going any faster, you'd have hollered enough, I guess. You were looking pretty peaked."
"I was not."
"Looked pretty scared to me. I bet Ma was hopping around back there like corn in a popper. How'd you like it, Ma?"
"I liked it all right," she said comfortably. "But don't do it again."
They passed a farm, and the boy waved at three open-mouthed kids in the yard. It was pretty good to be going somewhere. The mountains were plainer now in the south. He could see dark canyons cutting into the slopes, and there was snow on the upper peaks.
"How soon'll we get there, Pa?"
His father tapped his pipe out and put it away and laughed. Without bothering to answer, he began to sing. "Oh, I dug Snoqualmie River, and Lake Sammamish too, and paddled down to Kirkland in a little birch canoe. I built the Rocky Mountains and placed them where they are, sold whiskey to the Indians from behind a little bar." It was then, with the empty flat country wheeling by like a great turntable, the wheat fields and fences and the weathered peak of a barn rotating slowly as if in a dignified dance, wheeling and slipping behind and gone, and his father singing, that the strangeness first came over the boy. Somewhere, sometime, and there were mountains in it, and a stream, and a swing that he had fallen out of and cried, and he had mashed ripe blackberries in his hands, and his mother had wiped him off, straightening his stiff fingers and wiping hard. His mind caught on that memory from a time before there was any memory. He rubbed his fingertips against his palms and slid a little down in the seat. His father tramped on both pedals hard and leaned out of the car looking. He swung to stare at the boy as a startled idiot might have stared, and in a voice heavy with German gutturals he said,
"What it is in the class?"
"What?"
"Is in the class somedings. Besser you bleiben right here."
He climbed out, and the boy climbed out after him. The dog jumped overboard and rushed, and in the grass by the side of the road the boy saw the biggest snake he had ever seen, long and fat and sleepy. When it pulled itself in and faced the stiff-legged dog, he saw that the hind legs and tail of a gopher stuck out of the stretched mouth.
"Jiminy," he said, "he eats gophers whole."
His father stooped with hands on knees to stare at the snake, looked at the boy and wagged his head.
"Himmel," he said, "dot is a schlange, wat is a schlange, hm?"
"What is it?" the mother said from the car, and the boy yelled back,
"A snake, a great big snake, and he's got a whole gopher in his mouth."
His father chased the pup away, found a rock, and with one careful throw crushed the flat head. The body, as big around as the boy's ankle, tightened into a ridged convulsion of muscles, and the tail whipped back and forth. Stooping, Beau pulled on the gopher's tail. There was a wet, slupping noise, and the gopher slid out, coated with slime, and twice as long as he ought to have been.
"Head first," Beau said. "That's a hell of a way to die."
He lifted the snake by the tail.
"Look," he said, "he's longer than I am."
But Elsa made a face and turned her head while he fastened it to the forked top of a fence post. It trailed almost 2 feet on the ground. The tail still twitched.
"He'll twitch till the sun goes down," Beau said. "First guy that comes along here drunk is going to think he's got DTs."
He climbed into the car, and the boy followed.
"What was it, Pa?"
"Milk snake. They come into barns and milk cows dry sometimes. You saw what he did to that gopher, just like a suction pump."
"Gee,"
the boy said. He sat back and thought about how long and slick the gopher had been, and how the snake's mouth was all stretched, and it was a good feeling to have been along and to have shared something like that with his father. It was a trophy, a thing you would remember and tell about. And while he was thinking that already, before they got to the mountains at all, he had something to remember about the trip, he remembered that just before they saw the snake, he had been remembering something else. And he puckered his eyes in the sun, thinking. He had been right on the edge of it. It was right on the tip of his tongue. And then his father had tramped on the pedals. But it was something a long time ago, and there was a strangeness about it, something bothersome and a little scary. And it hurt his head the way it hurt his head to do arithmetical sums without pencil and paper. When you did them in your head, something went round like a wheel, and you had to keep looking inside to make sure that you didn't lose sight of the figures that were pasted up there somewhere. And if you did it very long at a time, you got a sick headache out of it. That was the way it felt when he almost remembered, only he hadn't been able to see what he knew was there. By 10 o'clock, They had left the graded road and were chugging up a winding trail with toothed rocks embedded in the ruts. Ahead of them the mountains looked low and disappointing, treeless, brown. The trail ducked into a narrow gulch, and the sides rose up around them, reddish gravel covered with bunch grass and sage.
"Gee whiz," the boy said, "these don't look like mountains."
"What'd you expect?" his father said. "Expect to step out onto a glacier?"
"But there aren't any trees," the boy said. "Gee whiz, there isn't even any water."
He stood up to look ahead. His father's foot went down on the low pedal, and the Ford growled at the grade.
"Come on, Lena,"
his father said. He hitched himself back and forth in the seat, helping the car over the hill, and then as they barely pulled over the hump and the sides of the gully fell away, there were the real mountains, high as heaven. The high slopes spiked and tufted with trees, and directly ahead of them a magnificent V-shaped door with the sun touching gray cliffs far back in, and a straight-edged violet shadow streaming from the eastern peak clear to the canyon floor.
"Well," his father's voice said, "I guess if you don't like it, we can drop you here and pick you up on the way back."
The boy turned back to his mother. She was sitting far forward on the edge of the seat.
"I guess we want to come along all right," she said, and laughed as if she might cry. "Anything as beautiful as that, don't we, Sonny?"
"You bet," he said. He remained standing all the way up over the gentle slope of the alluvial fan that aproned out from the canyon's mouth, and when they passed under the violet shadow, not violet any more, but cool gray, he tipped his head back and looked up miles and miles to the broken rock above. The road got rougher.
"Sit down," his father said. "First thing you know, you'll fall out on your head and sprain both your ankles."
He was in his very best mood. He said funny things to the car, coaxing it over steep pitches. He talked to it like a horse, scratched it under the dashboard, promised it an apple when they got there. Above them, the canyon walls opened out and back, went up steeply high and high and high, beyond the first walls that the boy had thought so terrific, away beyond those, piling peak on peak, and the sun touched and missed and touched again. The trail steepened. A jet of steam burst from the brass radiator cap. The car throbbed and labored. They all sat forward and urged it on, but it slowed, shook, stopped, and stood there steaming and shaking. And the motor died with a last lunging gasp.
"Is this as far as we can get?" the boy said.
The thought that they might be broken down right here on the threshold of wonder put him in a panic. He looked around. They were in a bare, rocky gorge. Not even any trees yet, though a stream tumbled down a bouldered channel on the left. But to get to trees and the real mountains, they had to go further, much further.
"Are we stuck?" he said.
His father grunted.
"Skin down to the creek and get a bucket of water."
The boy ran, came stumbling and staggering back with the pail. His mother had climbed out and put a rock under the hind wheel, and they stood close together while Beau, with a rag, made quick, stabbing turns at the radiator cap. The cap blew off, and steam went up for 6 feet, and they all jumped back. There was a sullen subterranean boiling deep under the hood.
"Now,"
Beau said. He poured a little water in, stepped back. In a minute the water came bubbling out. He poured again, and again the motor spit it out.
"Can't seem to keep anything on her stomach,"
he said, and winked at the boy. He didn't seem worried. The fourth dose stayed down. He filled the radiator till it ran over, screwed the plug in, and threw the pail in the back end.
"You two stay out," he said. "I'll see if she'll go over unloaded."
She wouldn't. She moved 2 feet, strangled, and died. The boy watched with his jaw hanging, remembering yesterday. But his father wasn't the same today. He just sat in the car and didn't swear at all, but winked at the boy and made a closing motion with his hand under his chin.
"Better shut that mouth," he said. "Some bird'll fly in there and build a nest."
To Elsa, he said,
"Can you kick that rock out from under the wheel?"
"Sure," she said. "But do you think—maybe we could walk from here?"
"Hell with it," he said cheerfully. I'll get her up if I have to lug her on my back.
She kicked the stone away, and he rolled backward down the hill, craning, steering with one hand. At the bottom, he cramped the wheels, got out and cranked, got in again, and turned around in the narrow road, making three or four angled tries before he made it. Then his hand waved, and there was the Ford coming up the hill backwards, kicking gravel down from under its straining hind wheels, angling across the road and back and up, and the motor roaring like a threshing engine until it went by them and on up to the crest and turned around with one quick, expert ducking motion, and they got in and were off again.
"Well," said Elsa in relief, "who would have thought of coming up backwards?"
"Got more power in reverse," Beau said. "Can't make it one way, try another."
"Yay!"
the boy said. He was standing up, watching the deep insides of the earth appear behind the angled rock, and his mind was soaring again, up into the heights where a hawk or eagle circled like a toy bird on a string.
"How do you like it?"
his mother shouted at him. He turned around and nodded his head, and she smiled at him. She looked excited herself. Her face had color in it, and the varnished grapes on her hat gave her a reckless, girlish look.
"Hi, Ma," he said. "Hi yourself."
He lifted his face and yelled with the pressure of happiness inside him. They lay on a ledge high up on the sunny east slope and looked out to the north through a notch cut as sharply as a wedge out of a pie. Far below them the golden plain spread level, golden tawny grass and golden green wheat, checker-bordered in a pattern as wide as the world. Back of them the spring they had followed up the slope welled out of the ledge, spread out in a narrow, swampy spot, and ran off down the hill. There were trees, a thick cluster of spruce against the bulge of the wall above, a clump of twinkling, sunny aspen down the slope, and in the canyon bottom below, a dense forest of soft maple. His mother had a bouquet of leaves in her hand, a bunch of spruce cones on the ground beside her. The three lay quietly, looking down over the steeply dropping wall to the V-shaped door, and beyond that to the plain. The boy wriggled his back against the rock, put his hand down to shift himself, brought it up, prickled with spruce needles. He picked them off, still staring down over the canyon gateway. They were far above the world he knew. The air was clearer, thinner. There was cold water running from the rock, and all around there were trees. And over the whole canyon, like a haze in the clear air, was that other thing, that memory or ghost of a memory, a swing he had fallen out of, the feel of his hands sticky with blackberries, his skin drinking cool shade, and his father's anger, the reflection of ecstasy, and the shadow of tears.
"I never knew till this minute," his mother said, "how I've missed the trees."
Nobody answered. They were all stuffed with lunch, pleasantly tired after the climb. Beau lay looking off down the canyon, and the sour smell of his pipe in that air was pleasant and clean. The boy saw his mother put the stem of a maple leaf in her mouth and make a half-pleased face at the bitter taste. Beau rose and dug a tin cup from the picnic box, walked to the spring and dipped himself a drink. He made a breathy sound of satisfaction.
"So cold it hurts your teeth," he said.
He brought Elsa a cup, and she drank.
"Brucey,"
she said, motioning with the cup. He started to get up, but his father filled the cup and brought it to him, making believe he was going to pour it on him. The boy ducked and reached for the cup. With his eyes on his father over the brim, he drank, testing the water to see if it really did hurt his teeth. The water was cold and silvery in his mouth, and when he swallowed, he felt it cold clear down to his stomach.
"It doesn't either hurt your teeth," he said.
He poured a little on his arm, and something jumped in his skin. It was his skin that remembered. Something numbingly cold, and then warm. He felt it now, the way you waded in it.
"Mom,"
he said.
"What?" Was it in Washington we went on a picnic like this and picked blackberries and I fell out of a swing and there were big trees and we found a river that was half cold and half warm? His father was relighting his pipe.
What do you know about Washington? You were only knee-high to a grasshopper when we lived there.
He looked at Elsa, and she made a curious, puzzled, almost warning face. They were both watching him.
"Well, I remember," the boy said. "I've been remembering it all day, ever since you sang that song about building the Rocky Mountains. You sang it that day, too. Don't you remember, Mom?"
"I don't know," she said doubtfully. "We went on picnics in Washington."
"What's this about a river with hot and cold running water?" his father said. "You must be remembering sometime you had a bath in a bathtub."
"I do not," the boy said. "I got blackberries mashed all over my hands, and Mom scrubbed me off, and then we found that river and waded in it, and half was hot and half was cold."
"Oh," his mother said. "I believe I do. Bo, you remember once up in the Cascades when we went out from Richmond with the Curtises, and little Bill Curtis fell in the lake?" She turned to the boy. "Was there a summer cottage there, a brown shingled house?"
"I don't know," the boy said. "I don't remember any Curtises, but I remember blackberries in that river and a swing."
"Your head is full of blackberries," his father said. "If it was the time we went out with the Curtises, there weren't any blackberries. That was in the spring."
"No," Elsa said. "It was in the fall, just after we moved to Richmond. And I think there was a place where one river from the mountains ran into another from the valley, and they ran alongside each other in the same channel. The mountain one was a lot colder. Don't you remember that trip with the Curtises, Bo?"
"Sure I remember it," he said. "We hired a buckboard and saw a black bear, and I won 6 bits from Joe Curtis pitching horseshoes."
"That's right," the mother said. "You remember the bear, Brucie?"
The boy shook his head. There wasn't any bear in what he remembered. Just feelings, things that made his skin prickle. His mother was looking at him, a little puzzled wrinkle between her eyes.
"It's funny you should remember such different things than we remember," she said. "Everything means something different to everybody, I guess."
She laughed, and the boy thought her eyes looked very odd and bright.
"It makes me feel as if I didn't know you at all," she said.
She brushed her face with the handful of leaves and watched Bo gathering up odds and ends and putting them in the basket.
"I wonder what each of us will remember about today."
"I wouldn't worry about it," he said. "You can depend on Bub here to remember a lot of things that didn't happen."
"I don't think he does," she said. "He's got a good memory." He picked up the box.
"It takes a good memory to remember things that never happened. I remember once a garter snake crawled into my crib and I used it for a belt to keep my breech clout on. They took it away from me and I bawled the crib so full of tears I had to swim for shore. I drifted in 3 days later on a checkerboard raft with a didi for a sail."
The boy stood up and brushed off his pants.
"You do too remember that river," he said.
His father grinned at him.
"Sure, only it wasn't quite as hot and cold as you make it out."
It was evening in the canyon, but when they reached the mouth again, they emerged into full afternoon, with 2 hours of sun left them. Bo stopped the car before they dipped into the gravelly wash between the foothills, and they all looked back at the steep thrust of the mountains, purpling in the shadows, the rock glowing golden red far back on the faces of the inner peaks. Elsa still held the bouquet of maple leaves in her hand.
"Well, there go the mountains of the moon," she said.
The moment was almost solemn. In the front seat, the boys stood up to look back. He felt the sun strong against the side of his face. The mountains, shearing up before him, were very real and solid. In a little while, as they went north, they would begin to melt together, and the patches of snow would appear far up on the northern slopes. His eyes went out of focus so that he saw the mountains as they would appear from the homestead on a clear day, a ghostly line on the horizon. He felt his father twist toward him, but the trance was so strong that he did not look down. When he finally did, he caught his mother and father looking at each other, the look they had for moments when he had pleased them or made them proud of him.
"Okay,
his father said, and stabbed him in the ribs with a hard thumb. Wipe the black bears out of your eyes. He started the car, and as they bounced down the rocky trail toward the road, he sang at the top of his voice, bellowing into the still, hot afternoon. I had a kid, and his name was Brucey. Squeezed black bears and found them juicy. Washed them off in a hot, cold river. Now you boil and now you shiver. Caught his pants so full of trout, he couldn't sit down till he got them out. Trout were boiled from the hot side river. Trout from the cold side, raw as liver. Ate the boiled ones, ate the raw, and then went howling home to maw. The boy looked up at his father, his laughter bubbling up, everything wonderful, the day a swell day, his mother clapping hands in time to his father's fool singing. Oh, for gosh sakes, he said, and ducked when his father pretended he was going to swat him one. Chapter 4 There were days in July when they went out together along the wheat field, the long, narrow strip stretching almost a mile from the pasture fence to the Montana line. They all carried pails of wheat, wet and swollen and sweet-smelling from strychnine, and dropped a tablespoonful at every gopher hole they found. This was the crucial time as far as the gophers were concerned. The wheat was a foot high, and the gophers liked it best at that stage, when they could break down the spears and get at the tender joints. Already, in spite of the boys trapping and snaring and poisoning, there were patches as big as a table along the edges of the field where the wheat was broken and eaten down close to the ground. "You ought to get out here with your traps more," Bo said. "You spend too much time in the pasture where it doesn't matter."
"They come down for water, though," the boy said. "There's one hole by the dam where I've caught 19 already."
"Well, you aren't catching them all," said his father. "If this poison doesn't thin them down, you'll have to trap all up and down this field."
"I'll get them. I sort of hate to poison them, because then I don't get the tails."
"Forget about the tails. You got to keep this field from looking as if it had the mange."
They went clear to the line, to the heavy iron post that marked the international boundary along the foot of the field, and back up the other side between the wheat and the flax. Bo was sweating heavily under his wide straw hat.
"I was a sucker to make that field so long and narrow," he said. "It'd be a lot handier if it was wider and not so long."
Elsa looked at him and smiled.
"You wanted to plow a furrow a mile long and straight as a string," she said.
"Well, I plowed her. Maybe I'm no farmer, but I plowed her a mile long and 6 inches deep and straight as the team could walk."
"I know,"
she said, and lifted her straw hat from her red hair to let the wind cool her.
"You've done fine with it."
Reaching down for a clod, he crumbled it between his fingers.
"Dry pretty far down," he said. "We could stand a rain."
"It'll rain," she said. "It has to. Even so, I think the wheat looks awfully good."
She wiped her forehead on her sleeve and smiled.
"It better," he said.
He looked down the green shimmer of the field and set the edges of his teeth precisely together.
"By God," he said, "if it doesn't make for us this year, I'll—" He could think of nothing bad enough to do. "It sure better rain," he said. "With wheat 2½ a bushel, it better rain."
"If we get a crop, will you fix up the house a little?" she said.
"Fix it up how?"
"Paint it, maybe, and rig some kind of water system so I could plant flowers and things."
"Old Mama," he said, "wants a cottage with roses round the door."
"Well, I do. It's so barren the way it is. It's like camping in the place. Ever since we went to the mountains, I've had the itch to fix it up."
"I'll tell you one thing," he said. "If we don't make it this year, we won't even be camping in it. We'll be going someplace where we can make a living."
"We've made a living. Even with the drought last year and the rust the year before, we made a living."
He stooped to lay a spoonful of poison at a gopher hole. "When we came up here," he said, "we didn't come up just to make a living. We came up to make a pile." They watched the sky those days, watched the southeast where the June rains had come from. Nothing but the fitful glare of heat lightning rewarded their watching, but even without rain the wheat grew strongly. From day to day the boy thought he could see the difference, for the days were warm and endless, and when he dug into the ground it was warm for 5 or 6 inches down. The gophers were under control, though there were still hundreds of them. He had almost 1,500 tails in the cigar box, tied into bundles of 100 so that he didn't have to spend all afternoon counting them, and he had taken to drowning out gophers along the coulee by the dam. There were always some there, now that the dry spell was on, and it was fun to sic Spot on the hole while he ran with buckets. Spot learned fast. He would stand quivering with excitement with his nose down the hole while the boy was gone, and when the water came he backed up one step and waited, whining and watching the hole. When the gopher popped out, wet and slick and dark with the water, Spot would snap once, and that was the end of Mr. Gopher. There were days during that hot July when they got into the ford and went down to the little stream by Pete and Emil and had a swim in the lukewarm, barely running water. Those were good days. But as July passed and the rain held off, a tension came into the house. His father sang less at breakfast-making, and he was likely to stand in the door facing another cloudless morning and swear under his breath. His mother went around often with her lips pressed together and her eyes worried, and he saw how she avoided talk whenever she could. When thunderheads did build up, the tension pulled harder, and there was a difference in the way they stood and watched. In June they had waited confidently, because if this one blew over, the ground was still good and moist, and there would be another one soon anyway. But now there was a half-expectation that the clouds would come to nothing, because there had been false alarms a half dozen times. Once or twice they watched storms get near enough to drop a few heavy pellets of rain in the baked dooryard and whistle their winds through the screens of the porch so that they ran to roll down the canvas blinds. But by the time they got the porch snug, the pelting would have stopped, and they would stand in the doorway again and see blue sky coming like a falsely smiling enemy behind the hopeful dark of the cloud. That tension invaded the private life of the boy, too. The farm was no longer a world invented simply for his exploration and delight. Seeing his father glum, his mother silent, he felt a compulsion to do something. The only thing he could do was to destroy gophers. And though they were not the real danger now, their decimation at least gave him the sense of helping. He was in the pasture and along the field 3 or 4 times a day, and from his lookout in the sleeping porch he kept the coulee bank always under his eye when he was in the house. The minute a gopher showed on the tawny slope he was out with a bucket, as if he belonged to a volunteer fire company. "By God!" his father would say irritably, looking up at the brassy summer sky. "There isn't a drop of rain in 1,000 miles. The boy's mother told him privately that there wasn't enough for Pa to do. If he had had stock to care for, or odd jobs to do, or anything, he wouldn't be so nervous. On an ordinary farm, if one crop failed, others would come through all right, and you would have your hogs, or your cattle, or your cowpeas, or whatever, even if your big crop didn't make. But here it was just sit and watch, and it was pretty hard on Pa. And if the wheat didn't make, there was nothing. He took to going out into the field alone, and they would see him walking along the edge of the wheat, green bronze now, stooping and straightening and taking little excursions into the grain that reached around his waist like green water. The first year they had come out, his mother said, 1915 that was. The wheat had been higher than Pa's head. He had just walked into Gadke's field and disappeared. Ever since then, Pa had had a great respect for Gadke as a farmer. But he hadn't had much of a field in that year himself, just 20 acres, because he was building the house and getting the fence in and getting the sod broken and everything. Even so, they had made over 1,000 bushel of wheat that year, more than they had made since, with 2 or 3 times the acreage in. The boy dreamed about the wheat at night now. Once he dreamed that he went out across the coulee, and there was the grain grown enormously, a wilderness, a woods of wheat, taller than tall, with great fat heads nodding far above him. And he ran back to the house with his mouth shouting words, calling his father to come and see, that when they got back the wheat had shriveled and blackened and died, and the field looked like a dark and smoky place that fire had passed over. His father flew into a rage and cuffed him for lying, and he awoke. As August moved on, day by cloudless day, they began to watch the southwest rather than the southeast. The days were hot, with light, hot, fingering winds that bent the wheat and died again, and in the evenings there was always a flicker of heat lightning. The southwest was dangerous in August. From that direction came the hot winds, blowing for 2 or 3 days at a time, that had withered and scorched the wheat last year. They were like chinooks, his father said, except that in summer they were hot as hell. You couldn't predict them, and you couldn't depend on their coming, but if they came, you were sunk. What a goddamn country, his father said. The boy heard them talking in bed at night, when they thought he was asleep, but even without that, he couldn't have missed how his father grew darker and more sullen and silent. The good humor was less frequent and never lasted. Even when he proposed to swim down by Pete and Emil, he did it as if it were a last resort to keep from flying all apart with worry and impotence. "Let's get out of here and do something," he would say. "Sit around here much longer and the roof will fall in on us."
"It's just this not being able to do anything," the boy's mother said. "It's this sitting without being able to do anything but sit."
That was why, the boy knew, she proposed the visit to the Garfields, who had come 2 years before to take up a homestead 4 miles east of them.
"We ought to know our neighbors better," she said. "They've lived here 2 years, and we've never even met them."
"I've met him," Beau said.
"Where?"
"Down at Cree. He's a prissy-faced, long-nosed Englishman."
"Well, but he's our nearest neighbor, and she might be nice." "Have they got any kids, Ma?" the boy asked. "I don't think so. I wish they had."
She looked at Beau and wheedled him.
"You'll drive us over on Sunday, won't you?" she said. "Just to be neighborly. It'll do you good."
He shrugged and picked up a magazine 4 months old and dog-eared from long use. The boy was excited by the visit to Garfield's. The hot afternoon was still and breathless, the air harder to breathe than usual. He knew there was a change in weather coming because the ginger snaps in their tall cardboard box were soft and bendable when he snitched a couple to stick in his pocket. He could tell, too, by his father's grumpiness that something was coming. If it was rain, everything would be dandy. There would be humming and singing again before breakfast. Maybe his father would let him ride the mare down to Cree for the mail. But if it was hail or hot wind, they'd have to walk soft and speak softer, and the crop might be ruined, and that would be calamity. He found more than he looked for at Garfield's. Mr. Garfield was tall and bald, with a big nose, and talked very softly and politely. The boy's father was determined not to like him right from the start. When Mr. Garfield said, "Dear, I think we might have a glass of lemonade, don't you?" the boy saw his parents look at each other, saw the beginning of a smile on his father's face, saw his mother purse her lips and shake her head ever so little. And when Mrs. Garfield, prim and spectacled, with a habit of tucking her head back and to one side while she listened to anyone talk, brought in the lemonade, the boy saw his father taste his and make a little face behind the glass. He hated any summer drink without ice in it, and kept his own beer at home, deep in the cellar hole where it would keep cool. But Mr. and Mrs. Garfield were nice people. They sat down in their new parlor and showed the boy's mother the rug and the gramophone. When the boy came up curiously to inspect the little box with a petunia-shaped horn, with a picture of a terrier and "His Master's Voice" painted on it, and when the Garfields found that he had never seen or heard a gramophone, they put on a cylinder like a big spool of tightly wrapped black thread, and pushed a lever and lowered a needle, and out came a man's voice singing in Scotch brogue. And his mother smiled and nodded and said, "My land, Harry Lauder! I heard him once a long time ago. Isn't it wonderful, Sonny?" It was wonderful, all right. He inspected it, reached out his fingers to touch things, wiggled the big horn to see if it was loose or screwed in. His father warned him sharply to keep his hands off, but Mr. Garfield smiled and said, "Oh, he can't hurt it. Let's play something else," and found a record about the saucy little bird on Nellie's hat that had them all laughing. They let him wind the machine and play the record over again, all by himself, and he was very careful. It was a fine machine. He wished he had one. About the time he had finished playing his sixth or seventh record, and George M. Cohan was singing, "She's a grand old rag, she's a high-flying flag, and forever in peace may she wave," he glanced at his father and saw that he was grouchy about something. He wasn't taking part in the conversation, but was sitting with his chin in his hand, staring out the window. Mr. Garfield was looking at him a little helplessly. His eyes met the boy's, and he motioned him over.
"What do you find to do all summer, young man?
Only child, are you?"
"No, sir. My brother's in White Mud. He's 12. He's got a job."
"So you came out on the farm to help," Mr. Garfield said. He had his hand on the boy's shoulder, and his voice was so kind that the boy lost his shyness and felt no embarrassment at all in being out there in the middle of the parlor with all of them looking at him. "I don't help much," he said. "I'm too little to do anything but drive the stone boat, Pa says. When I'm 12, he's going to get me a gun, and then I can go hunting."
"Hunting?" said Mr. Garfield. "What would you hunt?" "Oh, gophers and weasels. I got a pet weasel now. His name's Lucifer."
"Well," Mr. Garfield said, "you seem a manly little chap. What do you feed your weasel?"
"Gophers."
He thought it best not to say that the gophers were alive when he threw them in. He thought that probably Mr. Garfield would be a little shocked at that. Mr. Garfield straightened up and looked around at the grown-ups.
"Isn't it a shame," he said, "that there are so many predatory animals and pests in this country that we have to spend our time destroying them? I hate killing things."
"I hate weasels," the boy said. "I'm saving this one till he turns white, and then I'm going to skin him. Once I speared a weasel with a pitchfork in the chicken house, and he dropped right off the tine and ran up my leg and bit me after he was speared clean through." He finished breathlessly, and his mother smiled at him, motioning him not to talk so much. But Mr. Garfield was still looking at him kindly.
"So you want to make war on the cruel things, the weasels and hawks?" he said.
"Yes, sir." The boy looked at his mother, and it was all right. He hadn't spoiled anything by talking about the weasels.
"Now that reminds me," Mr. Garfield said, rising. "Maybe I've got something you would find useful."
He went into another room and came back with a .22 in his hand.
"Could you use this?"
"Yes, sir," the boy said. He had almost, in his excitement, said, "I hope to whisk in your piskers."
"If your parents will let you have it," Mr. Garfield said,
and raised his eyebrows at the boy's mother. He didn't look at the father, but the boy did.
"Can I, Pa?"
"I guess so," his father said.
"Sure."
"Thank Mr. Garfield nicely," his mother said.
"Gee," the boy said, "thanks, Mr. Garfield, ever so much."
"There's a promise goes with it," Mr. Garfield said.
"I'd like you to promise never to shoot anything with it but the bloodthirsty animals, the cruel ones like weasels and hawks. Never anything like birds or prairie dogs."
"How about butcher birds?"
"Butcher birds?"
"Shrikes," said the boy's mother. "We've got some over by our place. They kill all sorts of other things, snakes and gophers and other birds. They're worse than the hawks, because they kill just for the fun of it."
"By all means," said Mr. Garfield, "shoot the shrikes, a thing that kills for the fun of it."
He shook his head, and his voice got solemn, like the voice of Mr. McGregor, the Sunday school superintendent in town, when he was asking the benediction.
"There's something about the way the war drags on, or maybe it's just being in this new, clean country," Mr. Garfield said, "that makes me hate killing. I simply can't bear to shoot anything any more. Even a weasel."
The boy's father turned cold eyes away from Mr. Garfield and looked out the window. One big brown hand, a little dirty from the wheel of the car, rubbed against the day-old bristles of his jaws. Then he stood up and stretched.
"We got to be going," he said.
"I'll stay a while," Mr. Garfield said. "You just came. I wanted to show you my trees." The boy's mother stared.
"Trees?"
He smiled. "Sounds a bit..."